of tonight's live proms. It's over to the Royal Albert Hall and Penny Gore.
Thanks, Sean, and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall, where the BBC Symphony Orchestra has returned for its fourth prom this season, with the English conductor Jonathan Nott on the podium. But there's something of a French feel to the evening. In fact, the second half is completely French, with three orchestral pieces by Ravel. While in part one, we'll hear from a French soloist, the pianist Pierre-Laurent Aymard. He'll be giving the London premiere of a work for piano and orchestra by George Benjamin, Duet. We'll also hear music by George Ligeti, in which Aymard is an acknowledged master. But he and the orchestra begin with Mozart, the Piano Concerto No. 27. Now, this all came about because an old friend asked Mozart to take part in a concert in Vienna in the spring of 1791, and he decided that the occasion merited something completely new to play. There's a gentle simplicity to this music. It's not about virtuosic display, but about lyricism, and the finale seems to be modelled on a wistful song setting Mozart made immediately after the concerto. Come, sweet May, and turn the trees green again, and make the little violets bloom for me by the brook. Well, quite a small orchestral grouping for this opening concerto. The player's just been joined now by their leader, Andrew Haveron. The strings divided for this Mozart piece, with violins to either side and cellos and basses directly facing the conductor. And waiting in the wings, as it were, quite a battery of percussion, which we'll hear coming into its own a bit later in that piece by George Benjamin, Duet. And applause for soloist and conductor Pierre-Laurent Aymard, with Jonathan Nott bringing up the rear. And they're joining the BBC Symphony Orchestra to open the concert with Mozart's Piano Concerto No. 27.
Thank you. Thank you.
Piano Concerto No. 27, K595 by Mozart. As it turned out, the last piano concerto he wrote and his performance of it in Vienna in 1791 was also his own final appearance in public as a pianist. Pierre-Laurent Aimard and the BBC Symphony Orchestra have just played it here at the Proms, conducted by Jonathan Nott. And we heard Mozart's own cadenzas there, by the way. More Mozart piano concertos to come this season, two of them played by Louis Lofty and Leif Ove Andsnes. And here's Pierre-Laurent Aimard coming back on stage with Jonathan Nott, deep in conversation. Two of them know each other very well, share a love of French music in particular. Pierre Lamaymar, of course, a great champion of the music of Mozart, and he's made something of a special project of the concertos. He's recorded them with the Chamber Orchestra of Europe, directing the ensemble from the keyboard. In fact, he's become increasingly busy as an artistic director of various festivals and events, including Aldborough, so it's been a fairly hectic past few months for him. Well, he'll be back on stage in a couple of moments for a solo piece that links the two works for piano and orchestra in the first half of tonight's prom. He'll be playing the second piece in George Ligeti's Musica Ricercata, a set of 11 solo piano works composed in the early 1950s. And then straight after that comes the first London performance of George Benjamin's duet. Earlier today, the conductor Jonathan Knott explained to me how the idea for this progression of pieces came about.
We started off by thinking we would like to play this piece by George Benjamin. And then the question is, because it's such a condensed idea of a piano concerto, that we need really another piece for the solo pianist to play. So then we came to the idea, what could be the idea? Have you got the idea of dance going on in George's piece? It starts off with a piano solo, not particularly long, sort of half a minute or so. And this seems to be rather cleverly austere in its use of notes. And I thought, the Mozart itself is built up of very cleverly simple musical chunks, each of the three movements. But it'd be quite nice to sort of focus our mind after that on something where we really are talking about only one, perhaps two notes. And then it struck me straight off that this particular movement of this Ligeti does just that. You end up by listening really very carefully to one note.
Tonight's conductor, Jonathan Knott, who sees the programme in total, very much in terms of light and shade. Much more of that later in the three Ravel orchestral works in the second half. And that light and shade is also very important in the George Benjamin piece we'll hear in a few minutes. I asked Jonathan Knott whether duet could be seen as a piano concerto in all but name, and he thinks on the whole not. After all, George Benjamin has gone on record as saying that there's a fundamental incompatibility between piano and orchestra. So in order to write any piece in which the two elements come together, there needs to be a completely different way of looking at their relationship. Well, the piece begins, as Jonathan Knott said, with piano alone, playing a two-part invention. The orchestra jumps in as that introduction comes to an end, and the sparring partners begin to interact during the course of the next 10 minutes or so, briefly uniting, then parting, sometimes evoking the feel of a dance or of chiming bells. And as we'll hear, George Benjamin echoes the percussive nature of the piano with a good deal of percussion on the orchestral platform, a celesta II, a harp, and no high strings. There's just a very low orchestral timbre that we're going to be hearing in a couple of moments. George Benjamin turns 50 this year, and there are two of his works in the proms this season, as well as the one we'll hear tonight. His three inventions for chamber orchestra are in our late night prom on the 6th of August. That's with the Birmingham Contemporary Music Group and Ilan Volkov conducting them. Well, the music of George Ligeti, as Jonathan Knott said, prefacing the George Benjamin piece and echoing its spare textures. Pierre Lahoyemar is a great master of the work of Ligeti, and in fact worked very closely with the composer for many years. Here he is coming back on stage with Jonathan Knott. And so we'll hear this piece from Ligeti's Musica Ricercata, followed by George Benjamin's duet.
Thank you.
Duet for piano and orchestra by George Benjamin, receiving its London premiere, performed there by Pierre-Laurent Aymard and the BBC Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Jonathan Knott and prefaced by a solo piece, the Musica Ricercata No. 2 by George Ligeti. Pierre-Laurent Aymard and Jonathan Knott are both renowned interpreters of Ligeti and also great friends and colleagues of George Benjamin's. Composer and soloist are friends of long-standing and almost exact contemporaries. They've collaborated together many, many times. They both studied at the Paris Conservatoire in the 1970s and went on to work with the City's Ensemble Intercontemporain, as has Jonathan Knott, and he'll be working with them again next season. Pierre-Laurent Aymard coming back on stage now with Jonathan Knott, taking a solo bow for our pianist tonight. It's now 30 years since George Benjamin's Ringed by the Flat Horizon. His very first orchestral piece was premiered at the Proms to great acclaim. It's returned a couple of times since then. And don't forget, by the way, that you can explore our Proms archive online. That's in force from this year. You can search for performers, composers, soloists or pieces. There's a Proms quiz and you can create your own Proms Top 40. Just go to bbc.co.uk/proms. Well, that brings the first half of tonight's concert to a close. After the dance-like elements of George Benjamin's piece, the orchestra will be whirling into action again in the second half, playing three pieces by Ravel, two of which were inspired by the waltz. And before that, we're getting into the mood by heading off to Ravel's Paris. Barbara Kelly goes in search of the composer in some lesser-known parts of the French capital.
Born in Saint-Jean-de-Luz in 1875 to Basque and Swiss parents, Ravel moved to Paris when he was only 3 months old. He was always aware of the impact late 19th century Paris had on his thinking and on his creativity. He imagined other places, Spain, Greece, and the Orient. Yet these exotic places were always informed by his Parisian connections. For the next 20 minutes, I am going to explore some places that were important to Ravel at various moments of his life. All of these are in the 9th arrondissement, known as Montmartre. But it's not the touristic part of Montmartre, the artist quarter or the Sacré-Cœur. It's much more local, has a stronger sense of community. Indeed, I've heard it said that the 9th arrondissement is the musician's quarter of Paris. I'm outside the apartment of pianist Roy Howitt, who's had a lifelong passion for the music of Ravel. That you displayed for us?
It's a little minuet from round about 1905, which is just written on the back of some exercises by one of his students. And nobody's quite sure what it's doing there. It's obviously by him. I wonder if it's an early version of something for the sonatine.
Why is Ravel important for you?
It's like eating French cuisine. Even with all that French repertoire of that time, there's something slightly spiced and concentrated about Ravel. It just has that extra tang to it. Terrifically precise, but very concentrated in its emotion, and beautifully engineered. He came from a family of engineers, too. And the Oiseau Triste from Miroir, he just has a little oscillating pattern of two notes, and he's got this whole construction, a whole painting going on round about it, and you forget what's in the middle of it. The little oscillating doodle is just this. What he builds around it is you can trace elements of his piano writing to Liszt and Schumann, and it's often compared with Debussy, but it's his own sound world as well. His own friend said that he was like a butterfly collector, finding new harmonies, finding new way of doing things at the piano. Then he took the same sense of discovery and rethought the pieces orchestrally.
We've come round the corner from Roy's flat to Ravel's first Parisian home, Rue des Martyrs.
It's a street full of character and history. Its name comes from the legend concocted by the medieval monks of Saint-Denis, having been decapitated and walked up the whole street with his head under his arm over the top of Montmartre until he eventually got to Saint-Denis and suitably expired and was buried. But since then it has had a lot of artistic history. Here's where Ravel first moved in, round the corners where Chapré used to live. Madeleine Gray, the singer, was in number 48, just a few doors up from Ravel, and many years later, in his later years, he would come here and rehearse with her. It's not a far walk from Saint-Lazare, which is the area where the young Debussy lived. The whole Huitième and Neuvième were very much down-to-earth artists' quarters, not too expensive, just down the road from Montmartre, of course.
It's quite a colourful area here. It's quite a mixed community.
It's very down-to-earth and typically Parisian. It's not at all touristy. It's full of food shops, just now, the most marvellous food. But at the bottom is very much a community church, Notre-Dame de Lorette. It's where Bizet was baptised, where César Franck was married, and where Chapré's funeral service was. And then up at the top end of the street is the Iffy Quarter, of course, Pigalle. In a way, this is Paris, where all these things meet one at each end of the street.
And do you think that the fact that this is quite a mixed area had an impact on Ravel as he was growing up?
Oh, yes. He regarded himself as a real Parisian artisan, and this very basic down-to-earth quality, I think, was with him from early days.
We've come a few blocks from Ravel's first home to the rather grand foyer of the National Drama Academy, the Conservatoire, in Ravel's time. Ravel had a difficult relationship with the Conservatoire. and tried 5 times to win the prestigious composition prize, the Prix de Rome.
12th of March, 1900. I am indeed preparing for the Prix de Rome and have begun serious work. For the January examinations, I had patiently elaborated a scene from Caliroe and was strongly counting on its effect. The music was rather dull, prudently passionate, and its degree of boldness was accessible to those gentlemen of the Institute. All this ended up in a miserable failure. Fauré tried to cheer me up, but Monsieur Dubois, the director of the Conservatoire, assured him that he was deceiving himself about my musical talent. Will it be necessary to struggle for 5 years against this influence?
I've come through to the concert hall, where Ravel would have performed. If you look up to the ceiling, we have the great in the heavens, I guess, the great composers such as Handel, Bach, Mozart. And then we have on a slightly lower level, you could say slightly more minor composers, but still very important for Paris in different ways, Cherubini, Alévi, Erol, and a number of French writers too, such as Voltaire, Molière and Racine. I'm here with the French pianist Anne Kefelek, who has great memories of this place.
It's very moving for me to be again in this place. I played here for 4 or 5 very important final competitions, you know, at the end of the year in Paris Conservatoire. And it's a jewel. What you say, the beauty and the perfection of the shape of this intimate hall is so elegant, so graceful, and warm as well, with very subtle colors, red, green, golden, but in very subtle dégradé, if I could say so.
You performed and recorded Ravel, Debussy, Satie. What is it about those composers?
The musical life in France in these periods of end of 19th century and beginning of 20th was so rich and full of contrast. These three names, Ravel, Debussy and Satie, they were certainly admiring each other on different levels, but very complex relation, because Ravel, I think, was the one who was the most open-minded, certainly not at all pretentious, and he was able to admire colleagues, and he was also a very generous man, very, very generous. For instance, with Satie, he was a very special character, this Satie, and Ravel, on the contrary, was very tolerant with Satie. And so then, of course, Satie despised a little the behavior of Ravel because he was very nice with him. He said, for instance, when Ravel refused La Légion d'honneur, which was, you know, a decoration, Ravel refuses La Légion d'honneur, but all his music accepts it, which was already very naughty. And okay, you can refuse La Légion d'honneur, but it would be better not to have deserved it. I have recorded all Ravel music and the concerto as well. And what's striking for me in his music, that each piece has its a special character. You cannot compare Tombeau de Couperin, Gaspard de la Nuit, Valse Noble, Sonatine. Each piece is unique. He did not want to repeat himself, you know, never. Of course, certainly Ravel caught things, not only in Debussy, in Borodin, in Stravinsky, but he said that in art you are fed with others' richness, but after this you make your own honey, and this is the case, you know.
It's a nice image. You have your own influences, but the music itself is...
Yes, is unique, which is the case. Such a genius, opening doors and remaining himself. This is something difficult to analyze, impossible, in fact. And there is a phrase I like, which is, the talent does what he can, the genius does what he must.
pianist Anne Kefelek in the concert hall of the former conservatoire, which holds great significance for her as it did for Ravel. The complex relationships she's talked about between Ravel, Debussy and Satie played a key role in the Parisian music scene in the early 20th century. Here is Ravel writing later on in his 50s, reflecting back on the enigmatic composer we know best for his Génopédie.
A significant influence is that of Erik Satie, which has had appreciable effect upon Debussy, myself, and indeed most of the modern French composers. Satie was possessed of an extremely keen intelligence. His was the inventor's mind par excellence. Simply and ingeniously, Satie pointed the way. But as soon as another musician took to the trail he had indicated, Satie would immediately change his own orientation and without hesitation open up still another path to new fields of experimentation. He thus became the inspiration of countless progressive tendencies.
The Auberge du Clou is a café in the 9th arrondissement, just up the road from where Ravel lived as a young child. Satie became pianist at the Auberge in 1891. He met Ravel 2 years later, just round the corner. We know from Ravel's letters it was one of Ravel's nocturnal haunts as a young man at the Conservatoire. I'm sitting with François de Médicis, who's in Paris just now from the University of Montreal. What's your reaction to sitting in the Auberge du Clou?
For me, it's really moving. I mean, whenever I go to a place where major figures have lived, coming from North America, where you know history is very recent, being here and thinking that that's where Ravel and Satie have met, you know, it's like being in Vienna and thinking maybe like Schubert was looking at Beethoven drinking his buck of beer here. I'm wondering if Debussy was sitting in your place and Satie in mine, or Ravel in yours. And
do you think would quarrel?
Maybe, yeah, at the beginning of the evening, but after a couple of drinks, you know, I think they would loosen up. And in between, like, Satie would have to go play his shift and come back, and then, you know, they would have time to unwind. And I'm a bit surprised to see that the piano has disappeared.
Attracted Ravel to Satie?
A lot of people didn't take Satie seriously. Debussy was among the first ones, and Ravel had also a very sincere interest into Satie's music. And actually, we can see influences from Satie's music in Ravel's. In the case of Ravel, I think that there's another factor, that there was a rising generation who looked up at Satie, a group of six composers. The best known nowadays are Darius Milhaud, Arthur Honegger, and Francis Poulenc. They were like 20 years old at the end of the First World War. And they became champions of Satie, and also they were a bit anti-establishment, so they were pretty critical of Ravel. At the Musique Indépendante, they had like what they called a blind concert, where they would play the pieces by various composers, but not telling the listeners who the authors were. And there was, on that concert, Les Valses Nobles et Sentimentales by Ravel, and people laughed at the piece, and they were shocked, and people said, oh, it's Satie, and, you know, they thought it's too eccentric, like, who's that composer?
Ravel also wrote another waltz that created a bit of a stir in Paris in the immediate aftermath of the First World War, La Valse. And Milhaud writes about this with great distaste, that it's, he said, it's chansons for the ballet russe, it's something that's so out of kilter with its own time.
Yeah, there's elements of dance, of waltz that you find throughout Ravel's music, first like Valse Noble et Sentimentale, and also in Daphnis et Chloé, there's a number of waltzes. But what's very interesting with La Valse is that it takes on like a very tragic dimension. If you look also at the concerto for the left hand, it has also a kind of a very dark undertone. There's really like a tragic of existence in Ravel that becomes clearer toward the end of his career.
On one hand, he's regarded as being very old-fashioned and writing the La Valse, which it's the younger composers could not understand at all. Perhaps that very serious, tragic side was misunderstood in that period. But on the other, we can see him playing around with jazz, with the new sounds, almost as if he's participating in the music of the current period, but only doing so selectively.
He had a fine sense of assimilation. Yeah. I mean, like, when he started his career, exoticism was very trendy. And so, you know, like, at some point somebody said, oh, you know, why don't you go to Africa, like, or Middle East, like, to write a convincing Oriental tune? And he said, oh, I don't need to. With my imagination, I can just, like, render anything.
There's a wonderful statement of Roland Manuel, the young composer who didn't become part of the group Les Six, really because of his strong attachment to Ravel. He writes, Maurice Ravel as artist and man has always intrigued the critics because he slides from their grasp, eludes the intellectual analyst as he does the writer of romantic biographies.
I think actually that's an accurate description of Ravel, because like he disappeared behind his composition, and I think that's really what he wanted to do. Some composers, you cannot detach the biography from the work. And in Ravel, the attempts to try to link the two is really delicate.
If trying to make connections between Ravel the man and his music is complicated, we can be sure of two things in the post-World War I years. That Ravel was deeply affected by his experiences of war, in which he served as a truck driver. His piano suite, Le Tombeau de Couperin, finished in 1917, became, in part, a tribute to his friends who died in the war. Also, that the death of his mother in 1917 had a devastating impact. Here is Ravel writing to his friend Ida Godepska in 1919.
Dear Ida, my New Year's Eve will be grim. I'm thinking of those in former years, in the charming apartment on Avenue Carnot, where I was so happy. I'm thinking that it will soon be 3 years since she departed, and my despair increases daily. I'm thinking about it even more, since I have resumed work, that I no longer have this dear silent presence enveloping me with her infinite tenderness, which was, I see it now more than ever, my only reason for living.
In 1921, Ravel bought a house 30 miles outside Paris in Montfort-l'Amaury. Whenever he returned to the city, he would often stay at the Athens Hotel, in the 9th arrondissement, of course, where I'm meeting Roy Howitt again on my last stop of my tour of the area. I want to ask him about those difficult years in Ravel's life.
He lost his health, effectively. His life was completely turned round and upended. He came out of the end of the war having to come to terms with quite a different world, a Europe that had completely changed, but also try and get his own health back, and suddenly realise that the centre of his family life had gone. I think his way of working was a very intense one, so he would lock himself away to work. He would hardly sleep at all. He would be obsessed by a piece until he had got it done, and then he would then try and sleep, and then at some stage he would start answering letters, which had probably been piling up for 3 months.
And then he'd come to Paris again, to this hotel, where he would re-engage with his social life and go to concerts.
Yes, he'd see his friends, and he'd still have his insomnia, so he and his friends would sit and listen to jazz and go to cafes and sit half the night talking.
There is a striking contrast between Ravel's increasing isolation, his visits to a small hotel near the Casino de Paris, and his growing international fame in the 1920s. This tour of the 9th arrondissement of Paris has made me realise the stabilising impact this district had on him. Ravel wrote of many new places on his travels and noted the remarkable nature of foreign city landscapes. Yet he rarely, if ever, felt the need to write about this urban environment that had held such importance for so much of his life.
Barbara Kelly in Ravel's Paris. On her way around the 9th arrondissement, she met pianists Anne Kefelek and Roy Howard, and the writer on French music, François de Médicis. Sean Baker was the voice of Ravel, and the producer was Andy King. And welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall for the second half of tonight's BBC Symphony Orchestra Prom, live here on Radio 3 and online. Jonathan Knott conducts, and we're staying on Ravel's patch for the rest of this evening, though with more than a hint of Vienna. We'll be hearing three of Ravel's orchestral pieces, two of which started out as works for solo piano. And we've the luxury of enjoying them all in more or less a single span, one straight after the other. The evening ends with the delirious and distinctly apocalyptic whirling of La Valse. But our first taste of Vienna's most famous dance was written, said Ravel, in sincere imitation of Schubert. The Valse Noble Sentimentale of 1911, first performed, as we heard just now, at a concert in Paris, at which none of the composer's names was given. The piece wasn't a great success. There were even some boos from the audience. But, quietly determined as ever, Ravel had faith in the piece and made this orchestral version the following year. After that comes a delicate seascape, Une Barque sur l'Océan, another piano work that was later reborn in orchestral form. It's from a set of five keyboard character pieces published a few years earlier than the valse, under the collective title Miroir. And finally, La Valse itself, which Jonathan Knott was telling me earlier, should be a piece full of both darkness and light, from airy grace to dark destruction. Ravel's own concept of the music sounds like a film director's vision. Through whirling clouds, waltzing couples may be faintly distinguished. The clouds gradually scatter. One sees an immense hall peopled with a whirling crowd. The scene is gradually illuminated. The light of the chandeliers bursts forth. He said the setting was an imperial court about 1855, and gradually the elegance of the scene starts to unravel. The waltz whirls faster and faster towards destruction and chaos. The mad whirl, said Ravel, of some fantastic and fateful carousel. All the members of the BBC Symphony Orchestra are all in place for tonight's dancers, and here comes Jonathan Knott. We're going to start with some waltzes, the Valse Noble Sentimentale by Ravel. Ravel's Valse Noble Sentimental, and next Jonathan Nott takes the orchestra on a sea trip in Une Barque sur l'Océan from Miroir.
Thank you.
Ravel's fascination with the Viennese waltz finding expression in a way that's far removed from the light-hearted dancers of the Strauss family. La Valse ending the BBC Symphony Orchestra's prom with what some have seen as a dance of death for all its sweeping grace. A portrayal maybe of the end of an era as Ravel emerged from some of his traumatic experiences in the First World War. Radio 3's music feature Dancing the Apocalypse last Saturday explored the inspiration behind La Valse and its likely close connection to Ravel's wartime experiences. If you missed that, there's still time to listen again via the Radio 3 website, bbc.co.uk/radio3. And Jonathan Nott back on stage, really living every second of that piece. The tremendous verve and enthusiasm. He's guest conducting tonight, but his day job, as it were, is in Germany. He's principal conductor of the Bamberg Symphony Orchestra. Though he'll be making debuts with several other prominent orchestras in the next season, including the Philadelphia Orchestra and the German Symphony Orchestra, Berlin. Well, the BBC Symphony Orchestra are back on Sunday, next Sunday, the 8th of August, with their conductor laureate, Andrew Davis. Tomorrow, the BBC Scottish Symphony's here, with its chief conductor, Donald Runnicles, and that's at 7:30 tomorrow. For now, though, it's good night from the Royal Albert Hall, and we go waltzing back to Broadcasting House and to Jill Anderson.
Penny, thank you very much. That was Penny Gore at the Royal Albert Hall. Well, in tomorrow's prom, Nicola Benedetti, a former BBC Young Musician of the Year, will be playing. She'll be playing Vaughan Williams' The Lark Ascending. So I thought we'd hear her now playing some Mozart. This is the Adagio for Violin and Orchestra in EK261. James McMillan conducts the Academy of St Martin in the Fields.
Thank you.
Nicola Benedetti was playing Mozart's Adagio in E, K261, with the Academy of St Martin in the Fields, conducted by James McMillan. Well, coming up in about 8 minutes' time, the Lebrecht interview. Norman Lebrecht talks to the Australian conductor Simone Young, General Director of the Hamburg State Opera. To take us up to that, we're going to hear a transcription of one of Schubert's songs. This is Serenade. Schubert's Serenade, played by Nicola Benedetti, with the Academy of St Martin in the Fields, conducted by James McMillan. Now we return to Mozart and the Rondo for violin and orchestra in C, K373, which Mozart probably composed for the leader of the court orchestra in Salzburg. Here to play it once again is Nicola Benedetti. Mozart's Rondo in C, K373, was played by Nicola Benedetti with the Academy of St Martin in the Fields, conducted by James McMillan. And a reminder that Nicola will be playing The Lark Ascending in tomorrow's prom, which you can hear live here on BBC Radio 3, and it starts at 7:30. But now it's time for this week's Lebrecht interview, in which Norman Lebrecht talks to leading musical figures.
Simone Young is a mould breaker in a male-dominated occupation. She's been, over the past two decades, the first woman to conduct the Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra, the first to be artistic director of an international opera house, the first to conduct Elektra while 8 months pregnant, the first to demystify her profession by making it into a game show, the hotly contested Maestro on BBC Two. An Australian of Irish and Croat extraction, she's music director in Hamburg until 2015 and a popular figure on the circuit. But her ascent has not been without setbacks. She was dumped after 2 years as head of Australian Opera amid complaints that she was spending too much money. And her public profile has never been as high as that of some of her peacock colleagues. At 49, she's among the leaders in her field, a contender for the next big music director vacancy, at Berlin, Covent Garden, the Met. We meet mid-morning in a BBC studio. Simone Young, are you a morning person?
Very much so. I'm a total insomniac, so 5 o'clock onwards tends to be when my day starts. I love those early hours when the phone doesn't ring and nobody's really expecting an email to be answered. That's when I get my best study done and my best thinking done. I can survive for long stretches of time on very little sleep, but I have a rigid routine that falls into place on days when I'm performing, with a calm lunch no later than 2, and I sleep or meditate for an hour and a half in the afternoon before a performance. And you can't discuss anything with me that doesn't have to do with the evening performance for the hour or two before the show. Once we get to interval, I'm a human being again, but I have to stick to that routine because I have so many different threads. I'm not just music director in Hamburg, I'm also the general manager. I'm the intendant, which means everything to do in the house comes across my table. And it could be a 25-hour a day job if I let it. So to protect my performances and my focus as an artist, I have to have this quite rigid routine in the afternoons. I guess it's what keeps me sane.
Is that how you imagined it was going to be? All of that pressure? When you were a little girl and you thought of being a musician, did you think this is what I'm going to be into?
I never imagined for a minute that this was what I was going to be doing. I was very keen to be a musician, but I had no idea in which direction that would take me. Like most little girls, I played the piano and then took up the flute and played it in the school orchestra and sang in the choir, played guitar. Was very fortunate to be exposed to music by some great teachers.
In school?
In school. And
your
then
father was
school.
A teacher?
My father started life as a teacher and at age 40 reschooled as a lawyer. Very brave and not without its risks and not without its problems at the time, but he's always been a great inspiration to me. No, my family is completely non-musical. They still look at me and can't quite work out where I came from. But always the opportunity was there that if there was something I desperately wanted to do and I was determined to work hard at it, then the opportunity would be made available.
And you went to this Roman Catholic girls' college, Germaine Greer style, as we think of it. Was it as repressive still when you were growing up?
I started school in the 60s and life was still pretty traditional in Australia in the 60s. Massive change happened in Australia in the mid-70s when I was a teenager. Mm-hmm. And that was a great time to be a teenager and see political change, see social change. Australia finally acknowledged that it was a multicultural society.
But how did that rather convent upbringing affect you?
Well, certainly the restrictive side of it is something that is actually quite good to have to struggle against, I think. Mm-hmm. I see no problem with an education that is structured, because I think a mind has to be schooled to think in a structured fashion. And the one good thing, the one really good thing about this all-girl focused concentration of women in one environment was that there was nothing that anybody could say, well, the boys will do that. we wanted to put on a show. We had a fabulous school music teacher, Maggie Donnelly, who was an inspiration to me. And we did everything. We built the sets, we made the costumes, we sold the tickets, we set the chairs out, we swept up the stage. There was nothing that wasn't part of the activity. And that was great. You never thought of, I can't do that because that's boys' work, because there was no such thing.
And faith, was that important?
Yes, faith was important and still is important. I think, like most musicians, I would probably describe myself as a spiritual person. I read a lot about different religions and about spirituality. And I think it informs my work and it forms my understanding of composers who have drawn their inspiration a lot from their faith. I feel very drawn to the work of Messiaen, certainly not solely on that level, but I suspect there's some sort of connection. I think faith and art have a great deal in common. They are things that exist deeper than in the conscious knowledge, in the conscious mind. And as I said, I had no idea at that stage of wanting to do this insane job, but I think it was probably an excellent preparation for it.
And the beginnings of that job come where?
Well,
you get taken into Australian opera, and there are three conductors there. There's Charles McCarris, there's Richard Bonning, and there's the late lamented Stuart Challender.
And which fourth, of them? Carlo Felice Cillario.
Cillario, yeah. Which was the big influencer?
Well, they all were huge influences. For me personally, I'd probably have to say Stuart, of course, because I worked very closely with Stuart.
Mm. Tell us a bit about Stuart, because he's hardly known in this country and he died so young of AIDS.
It's a tragedy. I often think that the classical music scene in Australia would be a very different one had Stuart survived. He was dead when he was my age. And that's it's a terrible tragedy. Stuart was an extraordinary figure. He was, and we found common ground on many levels. He also came from a non-musical family. He was drawn to the German musical tradition. He was a pianist. He dabbled with composition. We met common ground on all of that. He'd never been truly satisfied with the traditional musical education, and he'd gone off to Germany at a young age to be a repetitor in an opera house. So parallels all along the line. Physically, we were completely different. I mean, Stuart was 6'4", and we used to call him the praying mantis because the arms were so incredibly long. He was a craggy man, very striking, very handsome man of really quite dominant features and a dominant physical personality and a wonderful intensity and calm within himself. And I assisted him for 2 or 3 years. We had our first real connection when he came back to Australia. He was brought back to Australia by Richard Bonning. When Richard was music director of Opera Australia, he brought back some wonderful Australian performers and brought them to really build the musical life in Sydney in the opera. And Stuart was one of those young conductors, talented young conductors in his early mid-30s. And I saw him, I was still a student at this time, and I saw him play a Falstaff rehearsal. First of all, he'd been conducting the rehearsal, and then he sat down and played the rehearsal. And I was just inspired by the intensity of his passion for this music and his incredible belief in getting it right and his determination with the language and with the musical text. And yet, having done all that detailed work, would throw himself into the score with such intense emotional spontaneity. And I thought, that's the kind of musician I really want to be. And I joined Opera Australia as a pianist, repetiteur. And one day there was a shortage of a pianist at a Valkyra rehearsal. And I, 23, had heard Valkyra, certainly never played it. They threw me into a rehearsal and I sight read Act One while Stuart conducted. It was a run-through, and at the end of the first act, he came over to the piano, said, the last person to do that around here was me, I think I hate you, and left. And the next day offered me the chance to assist him. So we'd found a great many musical and personal common ground, and I spent a wonderful couple of years working very closely with Stuart, also with his Seymour group. It was an opera and contemporary music group where we did new performances, new work, and I worked with him very closely on that. He was very encouraging to me and the one basically who said, okay, now you just have to leave. I was 24. and was already conducting quite a lot. It's hard to imagine, but this year, yes, I celebrate my 25th anniversary on the podium. And Stuart was the one who said, go, you have to go overseas. You're a very big fish here in a very little tiny pond. And now it's time to go and do your years in Germany, learn your languages, find out what a real pit sounds like. I mean, you can't imagine what I thought when I came to Europe and heard great orchestras in great pits. And the Sydney Opera House Orchestra, the Australian Opera and Ballet Orchestra that plays in the Sydney Opera House, they're an extraordinary bunch of incredibly dedicated musicians, possibly playing in the worst physical environment
exactly.
that exists in the
exactly.
world.
Exactly, they sound as if they're being strangled.
So he was right, and I came to Europe on various
So he really, it sounds as though Stuart invested you with a sense of mission.
Completely. Oh, he would drag me along to secondhand recording shops and say, you know, and I was really ignorant of everything except contemporary music because I'd studied composition. Anything that I'd had to play, so chamber music with piano or leader, and the operas I was working on, I didn't know anything else. And
you're a convent girl with a brand new baton.
That's right. And he said, you know, Bruno Walter, Brahms, buy it. Here's an old and scratched recording. I mean, he introduced me to Furtwängler. I'd never heard of Furtwängler. Where was I going to hear about Furtwängler? So Stuart really opened a musical world to me that was unthinkable. And I went to Europe in 1986 for 2 years. And where are we now? 2010.
And then Europe, you were working with James Conlon
That's
in
right.
Cologne and Daniel Barenboim in Berlin and Bayreuth.
I caught the last year of John Pritchard in Cologne. I actually started in Cologne under Pritchard, mm-hmm. Which was wonderful. And I was there just on a 3-month contract. And then they offered me a permanent position. And that was actually what set me into Europe. And I spent 6 years in Cologne working my way up, you know, doing it the old traditional way as a repetiteur, conducting backstage, moving up to being a Kapellmeister. And then James Conlon, I was James' personal musical assistant. He introduced me to Daniel. And that was, of course, a personal friendship and musical collaboration that possibly the most significant of my life, I would say, because Daniel introduced me to Wagner in a way that I hadn't imagined before. And it was very generous. I mean, you only have to look around my generation. Tony Pappano, Asher Fish, John Fiore, myself, even Thielemann, we all spent time as Daniel Barenboim's assistant. It's not a bad school.
No.
And Daniel didn't want an assistant who carried scores and served him coffee. He wanted somebody that he could say, I need to hear this act. You go into the pit and conduct it for me. And he'd go out into the house and be thinking about acoustic changes that needed to be made, either physically or simply internal balance. And so you, as a young musician, would get your hands on the big repertoire. And that was how I came to conduct so much Wagner so early in my career.
And he gave you your first endorsement as a conductor, but a bit of really rather qualified. I mean, let me quote what he said here. He said, I was slightly apprehensive about her conducting. I admit it freely because, I mean, whenever I've seen female conductors, I've been struck by the fact that either they try to conduct in a false masculine way and to show, you know, we women are just as strong and here we go, or else they didn't even try that and had a very effeminate nature and that didn't work at all. It's a double-edged compliment, isn't it? He's judging you on criteria by which you really shouldn't have to be judged.
And which he didn't judge me any further after I'd worked with him for a while. I think that's the whole thing about the woman issue, if
yeah.
you like, is that it's something of visual perception that actually orally has no significance whatsoever. I don't think you can put on any of my recordings and say that's the recording of a woman, just as I don't think you could necessarily put on a recording and say that's a recording of an American or that's a recording of an Englishman. You probably can recognise the sound of a particular orchestra and certainly the famous orchestras, but there's nothing inherent in the physical quality of sound that is either masculine or feminine. The range of expression within sound is infinite and begins in how one defines silence, how one defines the beginning of a sound from silence. I tried to explain it recently to someone. I was talking about articulation, and someone said to me, what is articulation? And we understand it most easily with words. Let's take a really simple word, cat. What is it? It's made up of three sounds, k, a, t, and you put them together, cat. Okay, now if I change one of those sounds, bet. I've dramatically changed the significance of what those sounds mean. That's all I've done, is change one of three sounds. Now, if you put that same idea into a musical sound,
into a phrase,
but also into a note. Mm-hmm. See, I think of music in many structures that start from the tiniest particle, that's the single note, through the vertical of the chord and the harmony that it creates, through the horizontal of the line that it creates, into the structure of the entire work. By changing the simple element of how you attack the beginning of the note, you can change the significance of the entire phrase. By changing cat to bat, by changing a hard attack on a violin to a soft attack that you give as a conductor so indistinctly that the musicians are kind of forced to sort of start somewhere together and the sound slides in. That's how you change sound. I don't see where masculine or feminine comes into that. And the gesture of a conductor, this is where, for me, Daniel's analogy of someone who's trying to be too strong or not trying at all means they're not thinking about the sound. Your sole job as a conductor is to communicate your conviction that a sound can be one way and one way only, and communicate with that with such clarity physically that the musicians don't even need to think about how they're going to play it, that it just happens, that you can then, and that's the glorious thing of working with a body of musicians regularly, is that one trusts more and more that this communication functions.
But that prejudice is very resistant to change within the musical profession. There are still, yourself apart, hardly any women who conduct at international level. You can count them on the fingers of one hand.
OK, but the key word there is hardly.
Right.
Let's go back 50 years, and there weren't any at all.
Okay.
And now there's Julia Jones conducting successfully at Covent Garden. There's Maren Alsop, who's been very successful. There's the Finnish girl, Susanna Malki.
And there's Emmanuel Haim.
Exactly. And there's Karin Kamensek, who's been an assistant of mine. She's just been appointed musical director in Hanover. So
they're coming through, and yet there's still occasions when they face a kind of hard wall of prejudice of the kind that Emmanuel Haim did with the Paris Opera Orchestra recently.
Of course, but it's not exclusively against women. I mean, being a conductor is a tough job. It's a really tough job. And the relationship between a conductor and an orchestra is a musical one. It's a personal one. It's coloured by the physical and political and financial situation that an orchestra finds itself in at a given time. There are so many factors that can really disturb that relationship between a conductor and an orchestra that actually have nothing to do with the musical communication.
Mm.
I think prejudice against women on the podium will continue for a long time, simply because the musical industry deals, to a large extent, often in stereotypes. We love the boy wunderkind. We love the grand maestro. Pick somebody off the street who's never been to a concert and ask them, what does a conductor look like? And they will describe Karajan or Bernstein. Or if they've seen a picture of him, they'll describe Simon Rattle. And that's where it will stop. They won't even think that it might be a woman in her 40s with long hair and high heels. It doesn't fall into the perception, and the music industry deals in perceptions to a great extent.
How do we change that perception?
How do you change that perception? By ignoring it, by believing that it doesn't matter, by getting irritated by it, to the extent that one believes that sometimes if you change the word woman and made it Asian or Jewish or gay, that what was being written couldn't actually be written in the first place.
Gustav Mahler once said that a musician who was a Jew was like a swimmer with a short arm. He had to work twice as hard to get to the end. Is that how you feel sometimes?
Look, when I started, I faced considerable opposition, which was essentially well-meaning. I was an extremely talented repetiteur, a very good coach, an excellent assistant, and I heard often, you'll never make it as a conductor. It's just not going to happen. The world's not ready for it. Why don't you just focus on being the best that you can at this, which you do very well?
Must have been good to be an Australian at that moment.
Well, it was actually in Australia that that was said to me, believe it or not, right back at the start. And I'm a pragmatist. I don't come from a wealthy family. I had to work, and I knew that I was going to give it 2 or 3 years and see how it went. And if it didn't work, then it wasn't meant to be. And I would go home and be very happy doing what I was doing. I love working with singers. I think singers are glorious, difficult, troubled, heavenly creatures who have the most impossible task, and when they do it well, it's one of the most wonderful things. And I'm deeply envious of anybody who can get up there and do it and do it well, and I love the fact that I can contribute to them doing well. But that was what actually made me want to conduct in the first place. I would do the preparation, I would do the coaching, and then I'd have to give these people and this music to somebody else to see it through to the end. And I wanted to be in there seeing it through to the end. And that was what made me want to conduct. I think people look at conductors and they see somebody, particularly when it's someone who looks like me, they see this smallish woman up there on the stage waving her arms around. I'm quite emotional and physical when I conduct. And upwards of 100 people doing what I want. And they imagine that that's some great feeling of power and that one is dealing in control. And it's got nothing to do with that. The relationship is about the sound. It's about the privilege. It's why I get incredibly focused in rehearsal and incredibly intense, because I believe it's a huge privilege that we classical musicians are given to be able to create this thing that can change somebody sitting there in the audience. It can change how they think about their vision of life, of spirituality, of everything. We have the capacity to move people because we are given the gift to be able to work with this extraordinary music and this incredible medium. And I feel that any attempt that is not the utmost that one can bring out, produce out of oneself, is a wasted opportunity.
The Vienna Philharmonic Orchestra asked you to conduct them after you'd worked with them in the opera and got on very well with them. This is an orchestra that's resisted allowing women into its ranks. It still only has two women as members. Didn't you fear that this was perhaps a bit of tokenism? Obviously, somebody was going to have to be the first woman to conduct them. But weren't you in some way or other being used?
No, I don't think so at all. I had the best possible introduction to this orchestra and to this city. I went to Vienna to the Volksoper to conduct Tales of Hoffmann, which I had never conducted before, but I had learnt with Bonning and Sutherland, so that was a pretty good school to start with. And I was given 2 weeks, basically, to learn the opera, and with a German text, which I found bizarre, for the Volksoper. I did it. I conducted the performance. There were a couple of important people in the audience that night, one of whom was the principal flautist from the Staatsoper, and another was Marta Domingo. And they both went back to the Staatsoper with reports of somebody doing some interesting conducting. Let me tell you, talented young conductors, even though we hear lots of names, talented young conductors who can really deliver a solid repertoire performance are few and far between. And they're what the industry needs, and it's like the broad base. It's like county cricket. You need that broad base for there to be a development that comes then through into the top league. And they went back to the Staatsoper with this information, and the next thing I had was an invitation to come and conduct La Bohème at the Staatsoper. It was November 20th, 93. I remember it very clearly, because I had no orchestral rehearsal whatsoever. And I was impressed by the cast. I had 2 days with the cast, and I thought they were fantastic. Amongst them was a very talented and as yet unheard of young Romanian soprano with very black hair and intense eyes, a certain Miss Gheorghiu. And we had a great time together. We got on fabulously. And I thought, I'm about to conduct La Bohème in the Vienna State Opera with one of the greatest orchestras in the world.
And you'd never seen them before? You actually saw them in the pit on the night?
I met the concertmaster. He introduced me. He said, have you conducted Bohème before? I said, yes, I've been conducting in Berlin for the last 2 years. Great, you know it, we know it, let's have fun. And in I went. And I stood shaking with fear, of course, outside the orchestra pit. I'd flown my parents over from Australia for the occasion, of course. They were pleased as punch. And I stood outside the pit and thought, OK, best and worst scenario. Best scenario is they're going to love me, I'm going to love them, we're going to have a great night of music making, and I'm going to return to this opera house for years to come in a wide variety of repertoire. Worst scenario, it's going to be two of the most embarrassing hours of my young life so far. It's going to be gruesome. I'm going to drink a good bottle of red wine afterwards, and I still will have been the first woman to conduct in the Vienna State Opera. That's not a bad worst. So, okay, get a hold of yourself, walk in and do it. You're about to conduct Bohème, one of my favourite pieces, with one of the world's greatest instruments. The orchestra is a conductor's instrument, and it's like, as a pianist, being given the most fantastic Steinway or Bösendorf to sit down and play music that you've only ever played on a smaller instrument. It was a great gift, and it was a fabulous relationship, and I worked, I've lost count of how many performances, but I've done something close to, I think, 30 different titles in Vienna. And then they invited me for a concert, which was great fun. And I'm returning there relatively soon for more Wagner and more Richard Strauss. And I'll be travelling with them as well. So it's been a long and life-building and music-building relationship. Gee, it's something wonderful to stand in front of that orchestra and hear the way they play the prelude to Lohengrin. It's ravishing. And that was the night they voted to accept women into the orchestra. And I conducted Lohengrin that night, 7.5 months pregnant. And as we took our bows at the end of the performance, Waltraut Meyer, who was the orchard that night, leant forward. One's very close to the double bass section there on the front of the stage, and she leant forward and said to them, "And now make the right decision." It took them a while to implement, but...
And I hear from a mutual friend that 3 hours after giving birth, you were back studying your scores.
Yeah, it's quite funny, actually. There's a photo of me the day my second daughter was born, and she'd taken her time about it, and so my concert schedule for that year was a little bit shaky, and I knew that my brain would be pretty well mashed for the next 10 days afterwards, so there's actually a photo of me putting Boeings in Bruckner parts in between contractions. I think I've earned the title of workaholic. I think that judgment's fallen.
I mean, it does seem to me that you work harder than is reasonably required. You've just come back from Bayreuth, where you've been studying the original parts of the Ring, that which you're performing in Hamburg. You've been looking at fingerings, you've been looking at Hans Richter's changes in the score. Now, I think of a lot of conductors who, had they perhaps been conducting at Bayreuth, might have gone to the archives and spent an afternoon there. But to go there specially, as you've done, to make an intensive study, that's going the extra mile.
Well, I think it's essential. As far as the Ring's concerned, it's, of course, a major project in Hamburg. Doing a Ring cycle for any opera house is a huge project. And for a conductor, you're putting your card out. This is my Ring cycle. And, of course, I've already conducted lots of Ring cycles. I've conducted lots of Ring opera performances. And I wanted my Ring in Hamburg to be, in terms of my own participation, a new venture, and not just regurgitating what I've done in Vienna and Berlin before. The only way I could do that was to go back to the sources.